Well, you ask the questions.
I will. I'm just going to give this like 2 seconds before All right. so you can okay. catch up to me. Today is November
31st.
January 31st, 2003. This is Christine Navarro. I'm interviewing Mr. Rudy Villalobos Sr.
Senior.
Is that your full name, sir?
Rudolph Villalobos.
Okay. And can I ask you, sir, your current residence?
I'm at, I live in Calexico, California, 722 North Preston Drive, 92231 in Calexico, California. It's on the Mexican border.
Okay. Can you tell me when and where you were born?
I was born in Anaheim, California on June 30th, 1923. I'll be 80 this coming June. And I'm one of 11 children. And I lived there in Anaheim most of my life up until where I went in the service and then came back and went to different schools out of the country. So I'd go back now and then, of course, and I did for many, many years, go back and forth to California. My mother was still living then.
Can you tell me a little bit about your parents?
My parents? My parents...
Their names too, please?
My dad's name is Manuel Villalobos. Actually, he was born Manuel Mayagoitia. That's my real name, but my dad couldn't get along with his father, so when he went to Arizona in 1904, to Clifton, Arizona in 1904, he just decided to use his mother's name, which is Villalobos, and so all our 11, we're all got stuck with the name Villalobos, but my actual birth name is Mayagoitia. It's a Basque name. My dad was born in Encarnacion de Díaz, Jalisco. He was born in June of 1882. My mother was born, my mother Leonor González was born in Jerez, Zacatecas in November 6th of 1892. My dad and mother were married in the little mission church at Isleta, Texas. Right here. They were married in 1910 at the Mission Church here in Isleta, Texas, while they were still apparently living in Clifton. I don't know what they were doing over here in Texas unless they might have gone back somewhere. But anyway, they lived many years there in Clifton, and then they went to, with quite a large family, I think there was 6 children. My older brothers and sisters were all born in Clifton, Arizona. And then my dad went to Anaheim in 1921 when my other brother was just 6 months old. And there's another brother born between me and Joe, who's only 10 months older than I am. I was born in Anaheim like I said, I think June 30th, 1923. So I'll be 90 this June. I went to high school. I went to high school, graduated in high school in 1941. 1941, I went to, after 1941, I after graduation, I worked for an aircraft company for 10 months there at Douglas Aircraft in Long Beach. The war had started. I waited just a little while to see if my buddy wouldn't want to go with me. We're very close together. Didn't want to go at that time, and I decided, well, the war is getting bad, I better join.
What was your motivating factor for joining?
I had been in the National Guard when I was 16 years old, California. I had already handled a rifle. I was in there 2 years with the National Guards when I was 16 to 18 years old. So I knew what a foot soldier went through, and I just figured, no, I didn't really want to be a foot soldier. Maybe better flying. So I was able to pick my job because I was only, I guess, 19. I could pick up the force I wanted to be into. So I wanted to get in the Air Force, which I did. I went to various schools, and they said that I would be a good radio operator. How little they knew, you know, I learned it. I did it well because I later became a lead operator for groups of 300 planes going. I'd be at the front leading all this in radio work, see. So I went to a lot of schools during that 1 year before we got together with our crew in Florida, and then we flew over to Goose Bay, and from Goose Bay to Iceland. There was a harrowing story that I would take a long time to get through.
Please share it.
Yes. Well, we there were six of our planes going over. Dead winter. This was March, and it was really cold when we landed in Labrador and Goose Bay, and but we just stayed overnight enough to fuel up and leave. Well, we left in a kind of a storm, and we got lost between our base there in Labrador and Iceland. It's not very far, but the weather was so bad. I understand we lost three airplanes and crews. There was only three of us that landed out of six. It got so bad there, we were lost. We were lost, and we didn't really know where we'd go, and the gas was low. At one point there, we had to really get down on the ground. We could see the icebergs. We had to jettison two brand new engines that we had in the bomb bays where the bombs generally go. We had two engines for replacements. We had 12 sets of 50 millimeter machine guns that we had to throw out because of the weight. We had to throw everything out, and they feathered the outboard engine, so we're just flying on two engines instead of four to save gas. Gasoline was going fast for some reason. But fortunately enough, I was able to pick up the sound on the radio. It got louder and louder, and we put it on this. We had a radio compass between the pilot and co-pilot, and when you get a sound on this plane, the plane will move over to that degree and fly into it. So you're going into a station. Well, we flew into it, and it was. But the pilot that I flew with all the time, is over there in Canada now. He retired. And he has Alzheimer's, and so I've really lost contact because he isn't able to write or read or anything. He doesn't know nothing. So we lost contact with Captain Chandler, but the co-pilot lives over here in Cedar Park, right out of just north of Austin, which I saw for the first time after 58 years last year. And I visited him just the day before yesterday when I was in Austin. And he was the one that told me, you know, a lot of stuff I didn't remember. And well, we flew together quite some time. And after we got to Iceland, we got down like everybody does, you know. Got down and kissed the earth, because that was probably the most harrowing experience I had, even after being shot at, lost over the Himalayas, and been the monsoons and the plains and the weather from India to China is so bad most of the time. And that's really bad. But the worst part was when we got started. We were almost lost. At one point, the pilot told me, he was a Christian, but he wasn't a Catholic. He asked me, does the crew know how to pray? Yeah, it got bad. Did you know the crew know how to pray? And I says, I don't know. We never really talked much about prayer, although I had my rosary with me. And I says, well, I'll go back and we'll pray. We'll just go back there and find out. A fellow from Paterson, New Jersey, my name is Bob Carlo, was a Catholic boy. He's only one of the group. Yeah, some other ones from Pennsylvania, probably Dutch, whatever they were. But the other ones for Pennsylvania. And I went back there and told them, hey, this thing is serious. And they were all asleep, really. And I had to rouse them up and everything. Oh, they all got really excited about being lost. And I says, well, that's the way it goes. Let's get together here. And so we were on pins and needles all those hours before we hit that little island of Iceland. Just a speck in the water, really, when you look at it. But we landed. And from there on out, it was relatively easy, you know. Just from there over to Brunswick, over to Scotland. Went to Scotland and landed, and then, of course, went down to our base in England, out of Norwich, England, where I stayed almost a year. Oh, no, it was just 8 months, really, actual flying, combat flying. Got through there, I guess, in, let's see, I got there April. went through all my missions, got back instead of 25, which was the maximum we could take at that time. But we had so many lost, so many ships lost and personnel lost, that we had to go five more missions. And not only five more, I went seven more. I went to 32 and got through those, luckily enough. And I was sent back, I guess sometime in April, May, June, July, August, September, October. I guess it was sometime September, October when I finished my tour up there in England, and I came back to the United States via Queen Elizabeth I troop ship. Must have been 20 or 30,000 of us coming back from England at that time. We landed in New York, and then from New York took a week's almost train trip from New York to Los Angeles, where I was later transferred from the 8th Air Force to the Air Transport Command. Air Transport Command, readily I flew from Long Beach to Australia, taking B-24s, pilot, co-pilot, and radioman, which I was. Did that on one occasion, got back, and I was transferred to India. We flew over to India, stayed there maybe 9 or 10 months till the war was over. I think, when was the war over? Let's see. July, August, I think August of 45, the war was over, and I stayed there until December. Most of the places in China were taken over by the Japanese, and I remember one flight after the war was over, we went to one place in China and picked up about 30 or 40 Chinese officers and took them over to Shanghai so they could gradually take over that base in Shanghai. And we stayed on that duty for about a month, delivering different Chinese officers to different places in China so they could take over all these places that that Japan had taken over during their 1939 invasion of Manchuria and got over to China. But I flew the hump, I guess 50 trips, it would be 100 times over that hump. Himalayas is going to start way up there at 29,000 feet and come back down into bottom part of Burma, where we flew at 8,000 feet. We go from India to China, a little place called landing field about 11,000 feet high. It was called Kermatola. Oh, sorry, no, that was in India. Kunming. Kunming and Luoyang were just the only two places that we landed, taking all this. I guess each load was at least 30 or 40 those 500-gallon tanks of gasoline. And it was quite, I never did worry about those things exploding. Now I would probably get scared to think about it. But at the time, they were all well loaded inside. We were flying in a relatively new aeroplane presented to the Indians, to us in India. It was a C-54, a DC-4, four-engine, brand new. Man, it was a pleasure to fly in because it was real safe. You knew if one engine go out, you'd have three other ones, see. And it was always handy to rely that you had good transportation. So all that time, I was flying back and forth, made 50 trips, say 100 trips over that Himalaya. And it was rough. It was rough. And there was times that I thought that I was better off in England flying against the Germans. But it all panned out. We got back just fine. And after my tour in India, instead of being flown back, I was a well-decorated soldier by that time, and they were letting the soldiers out according to credits you would get for the amount of time in the service, your rank, and the medals you got and everything. And I was way up there with 105. I think they were sending people out of the Army with 30 and 35 points, see? And I had 105 points, and here I was stuck in India. Couldn't get back by air, so we came back on this USS Richardson. Took us 30 days. And that's quite happy. I'm glad I did come, because I came through the Suez Canal. At least I saw it. I saw the locks. I saw it going through the Straits of Gibraltar and going into the North Sea. It was a good experience. In fact, a little story. We only fed us twice a day, and it was kind of skimpy. And one day I saw on the bulletin board, it says, help wanted in the kitchen. Here we are, well-decorated soldiers. I was a tech sergeant, you know, three stripes up and two back, and ribbons from one side to the other. And when you're aboard, all of us were veterans. There's nobody putting on any kind of medals or anything. We're all happy to get back. So I went to work in the kitchen so I could, you know, eat a little better. They had me making coffee for 5,000 men. That was something huge. You know, 100-pound sacks of beans, you know, put them in water, these huge things, and put boiling water through there and then test to see if the coffee was just right, and put it in these huge containers and give it to different people to feed different times, twice a day. But working in the kitchen, I could eat any time I wanted. Kitchen personnel, so that was kind of fun to get through those 30 days. When we left India, it was hot. We were in khakis. We got halfway out just past the Suez towards the North Sea, and it started snowing. It was November, latter part of November, because we got to New York, I think, around December 1. It was cold. It was cold. We just dug in our bags and got all our winter wear out. All our ODs we had never used. Never used. Now, they're kind of moldy, smelling things. They were in bags for all those, that 9-10 months I was in India. We never used anything but khaki, light clothing because of the heat. So we readily got our winter uniforms on when we landed in New York, and like you say, it was a week getting back from New York on train to the separation center. Went directly to San Pedro, California, where I was separated from the service. Actually, I had gotten in. There was two lines: one for signing up again for another tour. I figured, what am I going to do with all these thousands of people out there with any jobs or anything, you know? Once the war was over, industry stopped, you know, shipbuilding, plane building, everything went down. I figured, well, I'll just stay in the service a little while. You know, they pay well, you eat well, and you travel well. So I wasn't too far away from home. San Pedro was only 30 miles away. So I readily stayed and I got into one line. Well, the guys are pretty smart there at that center, at the separation center at San Pedro. And he says, well, you know, you better go home and talk to your family. And if you decide to come back, well, we'll be happy to take you. Okay, I'll just do that. So they gave me a furlough of 2 weeks, and I went back home. And nope, my mother wouldn't. Well, there was four of us in the service. I was one of four brothers in the service, and I probably guess the one was in most trouble most of the time. I mean, in most fronts, that is. The rest of them were in the Merchant Marine and Coast Guard, and one brother was a mechanic in the South Pacific, where he saw a little action, but as a motor mechanic. So I guess I was one of the group that was probably subjected to the most combat experience. So I went there and went home, talked to my mother. My dad had died by then. Mother said, no, Mico. She says, you know, I've been praying for you so much, and no, you're home. I want you to stay home. And my sisters, you know, all the brothers and sisters, oh, Rudy, what do you want to go back in for? We find a job, you go back to school, do something. Oh, okay. So went back to San Pedro and I got in the other line. No, I decided to leave. And that's when I left. And I went back to junior college and got this associate arts degree in about 78. And after, you know, they gave me more. I wasn't there over a year, but they gave me a year's credit for all the schooling I had gone through. I had gone through all these radio schools and technical schools and everything you can imagine. So they just give me all the credits for all these technical schools and everything. And I graduated instead of 2 years. 2 years there, I graduated actually in 1 year because I spent a month there. Well, after I graduated from there, that's when I heard from, I think I told you, this person that at the junior college told me there's a program over in Mexico. No, he didn't say about the program. He didn't know anything about the program. Whoops, erased that. He told me about the school. There's a GI school in Mexico City that takes soldiers, ex-soldiers. And
what was the name of the school?
Mexico City College. Mexico City College. And I said, well, okay. I stayed in Anaheim, I guess, for several months more before I got decided to... I went back to junior college to take another 6 or 8 months of study so I could go, you know, different 101 subjects so that I could go in as a junior in Mexico City College, which I did. Went back to junior college and got all these credits. So when I got to Mexico City, I went as a junior. That was, September of 1949. September 50, and from 50 to 51, I graduated in June with an associate arts degree in economics. With a bachelor of arts in economics from the Mexico City College.
What made you decide to go to Mexico City?
For that reason, to go to school. To go to school, that was it. To go to school, of course.
You didn't speak Spanish very well.
I didn't speak Spanish very well. I grew up in an American group of... my class of high school, there's only 5 Mexicans. And because the Mexicans didn't go to school.
What was it like in the military as well?
Oh, the military, I was the only Mexican in that whole 8th Air Force, I thought. I never saw a Mexican when I was overseas.
Did they treat you differently?
No, not at all. In Anaheim, they did. When I was a kid, they wouldn't let us go to the swimming pool until Friday night when they changed the water.
Check that out.
And only that, black people and Mexicans could go in. Because I was dark skinned. My other brothers and sisters, they'd go in any time when they wanted because they're güeros, no? But being the darkest of the family, they wouldn't let me in. I had Alfred Morris, track star, they wouldn't let him. We ran together. I was track captain in 1941, half miler. But anyway,
discrimination
I ever had was, and the guy that ran the pool was from Texas, Tex Middleton. there was a reason for that madness over there of discrimination. But in high school, I had no problems. In fact, I was voted track captain over a lot of sturdy people. I'm telling you, we had a good team. We were track champions for 41. We were football champions for 41. We were baseball champions for 41. And we were basketball champions for 41. Our class was terrific.
What was the name of your high school?
Anaheim Union High School. It was a terrific class of athletes, I'll tell you. Of course, we lost most of them during the war. All these buddies of mine, we lost so many people. We're the war class. We got out in June of 41, and most of them were in the service a year after, at least. Where am I?
You had just gone to Mexico City to complete your
bachelor's. Right. Yeah, bachelor's. And I got through with them. Did I tell you, I got married...
Tell me about how you met your wife, and your wife's name, please.
Well, it's quite a story, because I later found out that my great-grandfather and her great-grandfather were brothers. How do you like that? Through the Mayagoitia, I was telling you about. My dad's original name was Mayagoitia. So to go into it a little further, I was formally engaged to a girl in a little town where my grandmother was from, see, before I met her. But that didn't pan out. It just didn't pan out. And being in this little town, one of our relatives died, and I have a Jesuit uncle, Jesuit priest, who later married us in Mexico City. But he was down there. He was down there on the burial of his father, Gregorio Mayagoitia, relative. And the priest was going back to Mexico City, and I was able to buy a 41 Ford, drive to Mexico City from California in a 41 Ford. And I was really in style with that 41 Ford, and I was driving all over Mexico, went down there to this little place. It was about 6 hours away from Mexico City at that time. And when I was coming back to Mexico City after the the funeral, priest David Mayagoitia says, "Rodolfo, are you going back to?" No, I actually invited him. I knew he was coming back. And he was going by bus. "No, Father," I says, "I'm going back to Mexico City. Won't you drive with me?" "Oh, excelente." And so I drove back to Mexico City. And when we got to Mexico City, I left him off there at his, house. I guess it'd be something comparable to a convent house, I guess. Anyway, he told me, he says, "You know, Rodolfo, tomorrow night there's going to be a wake. You know, there's nine. There are, in Mexico, they have this, after a person dies, they have nine rosarios and all that afterwards." And he says, we're going to have a rosary over at this house. Actually, it was his aunt's house, which was my wife's grandmother. So I didn't know them at that time. I didn't know the family. And so it's okay. I'll be over there. And I went over there. So I met all the family. Later found out they were relatives, really. It was quite easy because my father and mother, my father was from Carnacion, where all this family is from. So it was really a family affair there. And I met, I was engaged at the time. So I didn't really make any overtures to anybody or anything at that time. But I think my wife put the spooks on this thing, because she said somewhere along the line, you know, if he comes to Mexico City from a big town, he says, he'll never marry that little girl in that little town, which came true. So I don't know if she put up a candle somewhere to St. Anthony to change the plans, but it really changed. And we got married in July 51. And soon after, that's when I went to work with the Department of Labor. That's when that program, they call it Public Law 78, was the law under which it was founded in Congress. Bracero program was Public Law 78 officially. So I think, is it down where I went to, or was that?
What's your? I'm going to interrupt you real quick. What is your wife's name?
Maria Teresa. Okay. Her maiden name was also Villalobos. Okay. No relative through the Villalobos, though. Okay. But anyway,
Tell me about who told you about the Bracero program.
It was one of our economics teacher. I don't remember his name now, at Mexico City College, and he said he told me about this program. Should be pretty soon, he says. Why don't you look into it? And like I told you, I really didn't do it for about a month or so. And then when I was in the American Embassy on Reforma there, getting my wife's immigration papers, I went up to the floor where the office was. They told me it was up in the floors up above, so I went to this office and was readily admitted there by an elderly statesman by the name of Earl Smith, who very, very congenial type person. I told him my background and my service, Army service. I'd been checked out pretty closely at that time in the Air Force, and my schooling and everything, and he thought that I would be the right person for that type job. Was interviewing. It was very simple. I told you, GS-5 is the bottom rung of immigration, of federal service. I think they go from 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, but 5 isn't very high up their ladder. And but it's readily a journeyman position at 5. And so I fill out the necessary paperwork. He finally found everything was on the floor, typewriters and everything. It wasn't a desk in the office. Found him, and I filled out the application for federal service and my passport and everything. I showed him, but I didn't have the birth certificate, which later became a problem, because after I went into it real deeply to find my birth certificate, found out the doctor never registered me. But the thing was, he was still alive, and fortunately enough, through telephones and calls and everything, I was able to get a delayed birth certificate. That's the only way they would do it. And there were still people around at that time that knew who, that I was born there and all, but really I got a birth certificate and came back, and it was nip and tuck there for a while because they wanted to see that birth certificate. So,
tell me a little bit about Mr. Smith and what his job was.
Mr. Smith, don't know much about the background. He was with the Labor Department, I'm sure, because that's the office he headed in Mexico City. Of course, over a period of years, I got to meet several high assistant Labor Department, assistant Secretary of Labor. He came down to Mexico to look at the program. And one occasion, a young fella by the name of Ted Kennedy came to visit us at Monterrey, Mexico. His brother, the president, had sent him personally to come down to check a few of the Racero program's doings, you know. So he must have been, couldn't have been over 25, very young. I don't even know if he was a senator. No, he wasn't a senator at that time. Probably out of law school or going to law school. He was very young. But anyway, Earl Smith set up a shop in Mexico City, and he was the one that hired all the personnel for Mexico City, including, but I don't think he hired this Joe Gonzalez I referred to. Because Joe Gonzalez came right out of Washington. I think that Senator Hayden, who was living at that time, was interested in him going out and getting some foreign experience. Because Joe Gonzalez never went overseas. He was in the service, became a lieutenant colonel, but was always administrative and everything, so he never saw any action per se. And I think knowing that he needed a little bit of background, overseas background, so he sent him over to Mexico from Washington, D.C., And so Earl Smith was a hiring person for all this. And like I said, I was the first one hired by him. And I was sent to Guadalajara. I had an option.
What year were you sent?
I was sent in that same year, July of 51. That's when the program actually started.
What was the center like when you got there?
Well, the center, it was the building that was finally given to us was a little place in Tlaquepaque. Tlaquepaque is a little... At that time, was a beautiful little town. It was very archaic and historical. That's the center of mariachi, the center of food, center of ceramics,
arts and crafts.
They had everything. This little town called Irapuato. Tlaquepaque, and that's where they send us. The little town of Tlaquepaque. But in that city, there was an old building that was abandoned, really. When we got in there, there was weeds and vines all over everything. So the first day we got in there...
How many were there of
you? I think I was the first to arrive. Joe Gonzalez arrived about the same time. There was Conet, I, Iragoitia, he worked there, and Sylvester, I... fellow from New Mexico, I'm forgetting names now.
That's okay.
It must have been Jack O'Grady came. Oh, he came a little bit later. Jack, we came about two or three months after Larry came, very important in the labor program. But anyway, must have been interviewers. Interviewers must have been six or seven interviewers, all U.S. citizens, hired probably out of Mexico City. And there was only, at that time, was just Joe Gonzalez who was the officer in charge. The officer in charge, and later a fellow by the name of Iragoitia came down, who was assistant manager. But at that time, they were called managers. So there was just Joe and six or seven of us.
What was the official name of the center?
There was no name to it. Actually, it was just the Guadalajara, it was just, I guess the Guadalajara Contracting Center. but it was in Irapuato, which is on the outskirts, and there's another little city all on its own, Tlaquepaque.
Irapuato's a big city now.
Yeah, Irapuato now it's a big city, but then it was very small. But we had very few personnel there at first, and it was quite interesting the way they brought in lots of help, I don't know if they're the same braceros that are waiting outside to be contracted or what, but they came in. They came in and started cleaning up everything. Everything was cleaned up, and the walls were dusted off, and everything was now like an old home. Big, big corridor. And that's where we set up the tables for interviewing. Big corridor. That's where we sat out there underneath the portico there and interviewed the people that were given to us by Gobernación. What's the equivalent of Gobernación in Spanish in Mexico, here in the United States? That's not Department of State, is it?
Probably.
Yeah?
I think it probably is.
Well, Gobernación is the service that has control of all this type work at that time. They took care of the Bracero program on the Mexican side.
How long did it take you to clear the offices and get the offices?
Well, I don't think it was a matter of days. It had to be because they had, at that time, they were screaming the United States for labor, you see. And in July, that's the height of labor, up there in Salinas and up in that area. The fruit comes in, June, May, June, July, August, September, October. So they wanted the people up there. We wanted them up there fast, so we gradually got to work pretty good, and were able to contract several hundred people. And this is where, again, Joe would come in handy, because we did all the interviewing. We just never stopped talking to people, all of us.
Tell us about the interviewing. Tell us you made.
Well, that interviewing, we were brand new at it, and we were treading rough ground as people learning not even the science. It was just, you had to learn on the job, because we didn't go to any school for this. Nobody came down and said, this is a bracero, and give you a picture of a bracero. Well, the picture is much like it's on the newspaper here. People like these here, there's one in particular on the cover here.
Tell us about the hands.
Well, we were readily given people from Jalisco, and we majority of people that the first group, of course, we had everything came in, because like I say, there was a lot of movements at that time that payoffs and stuff, the people wanted to get on these lists. They'd do anything to get on these lists, if they wanted 500 people in California at a certain time. We got the people out there, and maybe 1,000 people waiting outside or more at that certain moment, and we'd have to go through a whole bunch of them to get those 500 people on those trains and buses to go to the border, and we sat out there and we checked their, mainly talking to them. I knew enough Spanish to interview him. I never had any problem really with that. After being in Mexico for 3 years prior to this, my Spanish got better all the time. In fact, that was quite a story. When I met my present wife, of course, I was only married once. My mother-in-law let me come visit my wife, that is because I was going to teach her English and she was going to teach me guitar. My wife played guitar very well. We were going to teach me guitar, and I was going to teach her English. That was one of the reasons for visiting, supposedly. Well, with 9 children, I never learned the guitar, and she never learned any English, except the hard way living in the United States. But that was quite cute. She'd bring it up every once in a while. That was really something. But the Spanish came, and had good vocabulary after a short time.
Okay. Hi. I'm going to ask you a little bit more about specific questions regarding your role in the Bracero program.
All right.
What years did you work in the Brasetto program? How many years?
I worked from July of 51, the inception of the program, really. Yeah, I think there's a mistake in this paper here. It said 1950. Mm-hmm. And no, we opened the program in Mexico City in 51. Maybe the public law 78 was passed in 1950, but the center never, I told you, all when I walked in the office, there wasn't anything there except paperwork on the ground. And this was July of 51, so, and he was Mr. Start, this guy, Earl Smith. So it had to be, it had to start in 51, and we went until, that was interesting, because I was the first one hired and the last one out. In fact, I went to all the different centers, closed them up, gave all the properties and everything back to the American consulates and the keys and everything, the truck that I was using all this time, I gave it back to them and waited for my call from the immigration service, which I got due to Joel and Silas' influence. It's hard to get information. I was the first Mexican-American hired at Laredo, Texas, as an inspector. The first Mexican-American, 1965. So that was quite an honor, you know, because all of them are coming out of the Border Patrol. All the inspectors of immigration were coming out of Border Patrol. And I had no Border Patrol experience. I came out from the Department of Labor. So Joe Gonzalez was instrumental in getting some people in Washington to ask for me. So I was... So anyway.
You're a good friend. So you started in 1951.
51.
And what was your first job assignment?
My first job assignment was at the center. They call it Guadalajara, but like I said before, there's no specific name except I don't know. We had some. I think we had some kind of letrero. It said something about contracting center, but say Guadalajara because that was the biggest city. That's the second largest city in Mexico. Well, no, I think Monterrey now is the second outside of Mexico City. But that time Guadalajara was quite big, even for an old city as it is, founded in 1540 or 1550. Well, that was quite a long time, by Nuña Guzmán. Anyway, we started there in July of 51, and we ended in, my last job was in Guaymas, Sonora.
Okay, tell me how long you worked in Guadalajara.
Guadalajara, we're there 3 years approximately. I don't know if months and days, but round figures, about 3 years.
Were you
in 54? I was hired as an interviewer. Interviewer. All of us were hired as interviewers, starting out at like that GS-5 grade. We spent almost 3 years there in Guadalajara interviewing, and it was quite, you know, we were there interviewing. We thousands of people, of course, went through there in that short time. I don't know how many came through. Largest group probably was 1,000 one time, compared to other places where we had 5,000 one day in Monterrey, Mexico. But here, it was a small. It was in our office was right in the middle of a residential area, and that was what was bad about it. They had thousands of people gathered around, through there, around there, I don't know. It was good business for a lot of people there, you know, because where you have massive people, you have to have tacos and drinks and food and bedding or something. So I think the people, I didn't hear them complain too much because there's a lot of money involved.
Was the screening done inside the building?
The screening was done inside the building. We readily were given a certain amount of people. Lines of people were lined up, and each screener had just went as long as he could. We worked 8 hours a day, and we screened hundreds of people. Just hundreds, literally hundreds of people. I don't know. I guess in total, I could say I screened 500,000 people easily.
We've heard people talk about the hands and how. Inspectors
yes.
used to look at their hands. Tell me about that.
Naturally, the hands, even today, you see people who are field workers or construction workers. They have sturdy hands. People who work with machinery, who use their hands a lot, their hands denote what they're doing. Besides maybe the the strong features on the head, on the face, where they have, you know, you're out in the sun a lot, you have a lot of patas de gallo, no? You're out in the sun a lot, you get wrinkles real fast because the sun really, really has a toll on your skin. Let's face it, Mexican people, when they're 50 years old, they're already old. They're old people, you know, people out in the sun working out there, 50 years old. Boy, they've lived a lifetime. So when they come to us, we had you might say, the cream of the crop coming in. People of 20s, the 30s, and 40s. We had older people come in. We had one instance as kind of a, we had a midget come in. He must have been 3 foot tall. I got a picture of him, and that was eaten up too. I have a picture of one of the immigrants. See, we had immigration with us also. U.S. immigration came. They were set up because there was pre-screen. Labor Department would interview them, then they go through immigration. You know, if they said, well, yeah, I was deported such a place, well, that would be a cause for them to although it went very far, and no, but hardly you would expect these people, if something happened to them, if they were deported for something over there that wasn't really a crime, if they found him up there working against the regulations, they'd send him back to Mexico. Today, we wouldn't really consider it a crime, you know. But then, if you were deported for any reason at all, they wouldn't take you. These people were sometimes, didn't tell them. They just, no, we've never been in the United States, and that's all. But once they're in the United States, where they would check them out a little closer, sometimes it would come up. But with thousands and thousands of people, most of these people were apprehended, you know, people that shouldn't be back in the United States. So we had a large pool of people to pick from, and we readily went fast. I mean, you couldn't dwell too much on a person. It was kind of a flash thing. You see, the thing is, they all come in little groups. They're just like all families come in. They all look the same. All wearing the same clothes, the same, and you know, I could tell where they're from because of their hair gear or their shoes. I could really tell where they're from. You know, Michoacan, they carried a certain hat and had a little tassel in the back. They always had that little, the thing that went underneath, they carried in the back and had a little tassel, and the weave in the straw in the hat was of that state. I mean, that's what they wore. The Jalisco had the large brow, more charro type hat, you know, bigger up, and the shoes, the people, and we had different states come in. We had people from Nayarit come in with their costumes. They had red and yellow little hats and kind of fringe pants. But they'd come in, they wanted to work, so we'd hire them. But this little guy was, well, I think they wanted to know if they could actually get this kid through. Not kid, he must have been 35 years old. But he was a midget. But he was complete. I mean, he wasn't deformed. He was just small. And I have a picture with a guy. Now, you might have seen it somewhere along. He pictured with Gresham, the inspector of immigration. We were all standing one side, and we took a picture of him. This guy, for a living, used to dance in the streets, you know. You know, he'd dance with a Roomba and everything, but just a midget of a guy. I don't think I've ever seen anybody smaller in my life. But they contracted him. And they kind of chewed us out afterwards because he got up to the border, they couldn't do anything with him. He was too small, he couldn't do anything.
He was closer to the field.
Huh?
He was closer to the ground.
Yeah, but he couldn't carry anything. What are you going to do with a sack or with weights or something? The guy only weighed, you know, probably less than 100 pounds. Pick up a box? How's he going to pick up a box, Miko? So they kind of, we got a memo back from the port of entry saying that, please restrain from contracting this type of person. But anyway,
that's... Did you give a criteria of what... who could pass to the next level, or?
Well, yeah, that's it's kind of a standard.
What was the standard?
The standard was probably people who are within a weight. People who are fat generally aren't workers in the field. I mean, just generally speaking, they would be something else. You know, they'd probably be a store owner or a peluquero or something. But most of the people, all the Mexicans that work in the field, are lean people. Most of them are lean. I mean, they're muscular. They eat sparingly, but they eat their beans and tortillas, and that was a mainstay. And you could tell. some of those teeth were worn down, kind of, because they chew so much that the teeth are really, you look at them, they look like somebody filed their teeth off, because they use their teeth so much to grind their food, see? I mean, you can see these things. There's some people, like from Aguascalientes, different people, their water, mineral water, showed where the iron mineral, they stained their teeth. You know where they were from by looking at their teeth. Well, I didn't do that. The doctors looked at their teeth, and if they had teeth trouble, they would cut them out. Once we hired them, they went to the doctor. But the general makeup of a bracero is a typical field worker, as you would imagine to be in the field in Michoacán, Jalisco, Guanajuato. The great source of workers is Guanajuato, especially. But he was a lean. Most of them were rather not tall, 5'7" or 5'8". They just do have variations, but most of the people of Mexico are not very tall. And but they were lean people. They had strong physical characteristics. Their ruddy complexion. You could tell after a while who was in the field and who wasn't. And besides the hand thing would put the icing on the cake as far as accepting him. You know, put out your hand and you rub him. You could see him where they were doing that all the time, not just overnight on some kind of a stick trying to rub off his hand. See. You could see that. We saw that so often. But the overall characteristic was the people who never have seen a campesino in Mexico, it's very hard to describe him. Because what are you going to compare him? In the United States, there is no worker. You might compare him to the 30s and 20s when the Grapes of Wrath and that stuff, you know, lean people. I mean, those people were field workers. They were they were built and born during a time where there was a scarcity. So you didn't see any fat people. It just wasn't that available in the field workers, that is. Cotton pickers, oh man. Such a strain on that work.
Did the center operate year-round?
Yes. But actually it was seasonal. And during the winter, would be very few people selected for the winters. But most of it, and all the centers, was the same way. Peak season was mostly summer. Starting in April, March, April, May, and June, when things were, because different fields in Mexico, in the United States, took different type of labor. If they were preparing fields in the United States, they'd have to go a little earlier, you know, desaje, and especially in cotton, where they have to go through the fields and cut them back, and they'd have to go a little earlier. But most of the time, they didn't spend more than 3-4 months in the United States. That's all they really wanted to spend. They wanted up there and make a few bucks and come back home. Most of them didn't want to stay full time, except the younger people. But those who, most people we contracted were married people, family people who wanted to go up there and make some money and bring it back. That was the essence of the greatness of the program. Mexico flourished during that time because millions of dollars, if not billions of dollars, was being sent back to Mexico, as you well know, through they're talking here about the economics of Mexico. Right now, President Fox is wanting this program again because it's another source of income. Bracero's money at that time was number two, I think, in income. First, I think it was tourism. Mm-hmm. Then it was Bracero's, and then I think it was Petróleos, where all their money came from. So they were eager to keep this program going, and it did. It did help the economy. There's no doubt about it.
How many applicants would you estimate there were on any given day?
It varied on. See, the applicants varied with the demand. The farmers would notify the center, or the centers like in El Centro, California, which carried most of the people out of Guadalajara over to California, and the centers at Irapuato came through El Paso, a little closer. So we had different centers supplying, like Chihuahua was mainly El Paso. It wouldn't go any other place because of the directness from El Paso to the border. But it all depends on the season and what they wanted. But mainly it was full steam ahead with laborers, and they would segregate them, I guess, what they needed at the borders. But sometimes we didn't have special requests for date pickers, like out of Indio in that area where they wanted people who had experience. And date, you know, those palms are 40 or 50 feet high, and you had to know how to get up there and pick those dates. And it was always... Dayton, yeah, but that's very small comparison to Indio. Dates in Indio were great. And they would we'd often go out into the groups and ask for specialists. We'd ask, how many have experience in date and want to go? Oh, they want to go because they knew it would, even though the dangers was there, they knew that the short time they could make more money. They made more money picking dates than a lot of things.
Almost to climb up 40 feet.
Well, they got in the buckets and they up way up there in those heights, but once you learn how to do it, they got paid better, and it was just a little bit better paying work.
After Guadalajara in 1954, where did you go next, and why did you go to the next?
After Guadalajara, they closed the center at Guadalajara.
Do you know why?
No, off the top of my head, I don't know why.
I would imagine probably...
Joe would tell you. Joe and Silas could tell you why they closed the center.
Maybe they'd give it another area.
They might, yeah. It was strictly government whims of what they did and what they didn't do. But they closed the one in Guadalajara. It was probably cost them a lot more to send them from Guadalajara than it was from Monterrey. Monterrey is very close to the border.
Is that where you went next?
Yeah. I went to Monterrey in 1954. We got over there sometime in the middle of the summer. No, we got there March of 54, because Joe just got married, and he and his wife went to live at that hotel there in Monterrey. It was March. It was 104 degrees in March, and she says, "What am I doing here in Mexico?" Opal was out of Washington, D.C. She was she didn't know any Spanish. She didn't know anything, but she came to Mexico anyway, and it was quite nice having her around and knowing her.
How long were you in Monterrey?
Monterrey, we spent from 1954 to 1963. That's 9 years, about 9 years.
What were the major differences between Guadalajara and Monterrey?
Well, there wasn't any major difference as far as the work was concerned. We had more work, if that has anything to do with it. Monterrey became the largest contracting center in Mexico, outside of Irapuato. Irapuato was doing great, but we had, like I say, we're working 5,000 people a day. Now my job, see, when I was an interviewer, I was GS5. Well, I got ascended to GS7, supervisor of transportation and feeding. That was my title. Supervisor of Transportation and Feeding. I didn't do any more interviewing then.
In Monterrey?
In Monterrey, Mexico. I didn't do any more interviewing. Although I did sit down sometimes when it was so much work, I needed so much help, that I did sit down on occasions to help interview. My expertise, we got pretty good. We got pretty good. And the people were very happy with the people we were sending, see, because we did try to eliminate a lot of the goofballs, you might call, that try to get through. We weren't really campesinos. They weren't campesinos.
How many were on staff in Monterrey?
Monterrey, we had a larger staff, especially typists. We had women typists typing up the contracts. They typed up the contracts. I think in this picture, one of these pictures is a picture of a contract. No, this is an identification card that we later were receiving. No, the contract's not in there. But they put their names, date of birth, next of kin, and the whole setup, more or less, so that we'd have that on file. But we had more personnel, more Mexican personnel working.
That's a huge building.
It was huge. Well, we went to the Monterrey Bracero Contracting Center was we were given one big building in the military camp, so it was nice. It was right in the military camp. It was quite large. Quite large. Military camp was large, and I guess one of the military buildings. So we outfitted it with tables and chairs, and we had at one time, we must have had, 10 or 15 secretaries, t- typing all day long, typing, all these things on typing. And then we had interviewers. We had, must have had, wasn't that American personnel? Guy Mueller was ahead of that group then.
What was his name? I'm sorry.
Guy Mueller was head of the he was a, I guess, supervisor of personnel there. Joe was the officer in charge. He was a center manager. This Joe here, Joe
in Monterey.
Also,
could you say his full name, please?
Joe E. Gonzalez, spelled with an S. Gonzalez with an S. That's where his dad spelled it, and that's where they spelled it, with a Joey Gonzalez. Escudero, Joe Escudero Gonzalez. He never used his name Escudero, but that was his middle name. That was his mother's maiden name. Joe Escudero, Joey Gonzalez. We just transferred everything we could. We transferred over to Monterey, set up business real fast.
How long did it take you?
Matter of days. Matter of short days. Closed one time, we were gone almost the next, I think is what it sounded like. Didn't spend any time at all. We went to Monterey in 54. We immediately went to work contracting people. And there was big. We had an average, I would say, of 3,000 or 4,000 contracted a day. We have upwards of 10,000 or 15,000 people with the labor pool. You see, all these cities in Mexico, the Republic of Mexico, would get in touch with Gobernación, and Gobernación would say, "All right, from this community over there in Guadalajara, Monterrey." Well, Monterrey really didn't have a lot of campesinos per se, because that was an industrial town. So most of the people that come there, we came out of different cities in like Torreón, Durango,
San Luis Potosí,
all that area was above Monterrey. And of course they filled it in from all over Mexico. But we had a big movement, and I wrote out checks for the U.S. government for transportation, thousands of dollars.
How did you transport them? Tell me.
We transported them mainly in train. Now that in itself is, you know, by standards of today's standards, you know, say, well, that was inhuman, and it was in a sense, because we put in maybe I don't exactly remember how many it was, but they outfitted these railroad cars. They outfitted the railroad cars with wooden seats, benches around, and then in the middle, and in one corner. They'd have this huge tank with water, you know, potable water. And then have a whole bunch of cups, these little water cups in one corner. Well, you're going in. Monterey was an exceptionally hot town. You get up to 100 degrees easy during the summer, 104, 105, 110 degrees. And these people inside these boxcars, no air conditioning, doors were open, but readily very happy because they had a contract in their hand and they had lunches to go with, because every time a man would get contract, we give him a hot meal.
So once you hired him.
Yeah, once we gave him a hot meal, and that's where I came in, because I was always being that. See, these contractors had to give a certain amount of meals and a weight, like meat weight. They had, you know, potatoes and beans and like a stew. And they had beans and everything else, and tortillas, real tortillas. I mean, they didn't have bread. At one time, you were serving bread, but most of the time it was tortillas. And that's what they liked best, tortillas de maíz. They had no tortillas de harina. And but that was my job, to see that they got from the contracting center. They would be led over to the kitchen, which was an army kitchen, which was good because it was set up for big deals, you know, big burners. We had big kettles and boiling beans and making coffee and all these things. Say, but when you prepare for 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 men, it's a long day's process. We have to start sometimes 4 or 5 in the morning to get things started, so we start feeding the people, you know, or 8 or 9 in the morning. So
how did you hire staff, locals?
No, it was all contracted. The they had a food contractor, and we had several bidders. And they put up, all right, so much a meal. We'll serve a meal for so much, and there was three, four, or five bids, and they'd take the lowest bid, and his contractor would go in, and he would set up, and it was my job to see that what was in the contract, these people were fed. Because it's very easy. If you skimp a few grams on each piece of meat, it's a whole cow at the end of the day, because there was a lot of meat served. They had these deep freezers in there, and they had carcasses all over everything. And we fed a lot of people. And lunches. And we gave sometimes two lunches per person because of the day and a half trip to the border. And all those lunches were given after the... We have to readily check the check, because some people were going to different places. They don't all go to one place. But that was something, making lunches up for 3,000 or 4,000 people. And on days it was 5,000, not every day. But we had several days where we did have 5,000 contracted a day. That was the only center in Mexico that did that. Irapuato was big, and they contracted several hundred and thousands of people a day, but they really didn't stay open as long as we did in Monterrey.
Did they work on weekends?
Oh, yeah. We worked Saturday and Sundays every day, and it wasn't... anytime we get an order from the United States, they'd send it in, and we fill them up, the whole thing. So many thousands of workers here and there. And we didn't... We couldn't at that time, as I remember, segregate them as to what jobs they were going to do. In some lines I did. I don't remember. That's been too long now. But we did have people who maybe wanted to go into cotton. In other words, go into was very hard stoop labor. Betadelques, beet topping. They didn't have the machines those years that they have now. Now they hardly have any labor for beets. But they had beet topping, bending. Boy, that was a rugged job, but they paid fairly well. But they did have a plan for these people. They were all hired. Most of these people were all sent to California from Guadalajara. The ones from Monterrey were sent to Eagle Pass and to El Paso. From Monterrey, Eagle Pass took a lot of people at one time. We had a bus line, a very good bus line, hired. We'd have 50 or 150 buses, all loaded to go one time. We had trains also at the same time. When you're transporting 5,000 people, that's a lot of transportation. And those we never every once in a while they'd throw in a few passenger cars. You know, they were first class in, windows wide open, and these people were happy when they could sit down like human beings, you might say.
Were there any other problems that
no,
you encountered down there when you were down there?
Well, no, never really did. I mean, you had a group that was happy to be contracted. There were one or two troublemakers I used to run into. That I had to get rid of one way or the other. That looked like rabble rousers. I don't know how they got in there, but they were contracted, and all of a sudden it started. But that was neither here nor there. That was very little. But there were a few that get kind of hard to get along with to get them on trains. They didn't want to get on the train. They didn't want this, and they wanted more lunches. They wanted more of this. But that was the difference between a bracero, a real bracero, and the people that hired that were really braceros. The bracero was a very humble type person. He was humble. You'd never hear a squeak out of him. They were so happy to have that piece of paper contract in their hand. I have pictures of all this that went down the drain. God, I hate to think about it. Especially now that I had an album this thick of photographs that are taken from the beginning to the end.
I remember some when they were naked.
Yeah, I got pictures of them in the back room there, back ends.
Yeah, it's just the rear end.
Yeah.
But they're checking them out.
Yeah.
Just in the doctor.
They'd have to spray them with insecticide with powder for flea powder or something.
Yeah, I hope not.
But they spray them like that because there's a lot of lice and stuff. Lots of it's coming through.
Okay, today is February 3rd. I'm interviewing Mr. Villalobos at his home. At his son's home, I should say.
Yeah.
Good morning. How are you this morning?
Fine, Christina, just fine. Thank you.
Good. If I could just go ahead and let's talk a little bit about Guadalajara and some of the people that you worked with in Guadalajara.
All right.
Do you want to talk about who different well, supervisors?
When we opened the center there in probably sometime July of 51, there was a young man from, I think was sent directly from Washington, by the name of Joe E. Gonzalez. Joe E. Gonzalez is native Arizonan. And he was there. The personnel was coming little by little. The place hadn't been cleaned up, so they spent a few days cleaning up all the shrubbery. Like I think I might have mentioned before, it's an old elegant house that was probably not rented at the time, and big long corridors and a lot of rooms, and it was just right for us, just right for our type of operation, although it was in one of the neighborhoods there. But however, everybody got along with so many people around them. But when I got there, Joe Gonzalez was the manager, center manager was his title. And I arrived there. Rudy Villalobos arrived there, and we had a fellow by the name of Conant out of New Mexico. He came in as an interviewer. We had a fellow by the name of Leon Sylvester, as I remember. I don't know where he came from, but everybody was bilingual. That was one of the requirements for the job. And there was an assistant manager came in by name of, they called him Larry Laragoitia. I think he was also from New Mexico. And later on, a few weeks, months later, a fellow by name of John O'Grady. John O'Grady came. So we weren't too many inspectors at that time, and it really didn't take a whole bunch to do the job, apparently. Everybody's working fast, and we got through relatively well during the day for, say, 1,000 people. But it took a little doing at first, knowing each other and getting accustomed to our job. But there was another person from New Mexico there. I don't know what his name is. But that basically was the personnel there at that time, 1951. And most of us stayed on there until the center was closed in 1954, where we transferred all our operations and some of the equipment over to Monterrey, Mexico.
Can you describe the daily routine in Guadalajara, what it was like in Guadalajara, say a typical day?
Well, a typical day was arriving at the center and awaiting the jefe. They call him jefe de gobernación. He was in charge of receiving the lists from the different municipalities all over that area that were sending men. So it was in the morning. The first thing they did was to get together with the Mexican authorities there who were running the center on the Mexican side and start the day. Start finding out who was going to be called and how they're going to be called and setting up. It was all a new procedure that hadn't been done in Mexico. So readily the things in the morning was to get everything ready, get all the typists in position. We had several girls, we must have had at that time at least maybe half a dozen off the top of my head who were typists there. So it wasn't confusion by any means, but it was getting setting up the tables under the roof. It's kind of like a veranda out there on the first floor. Well, it was only one first floor anyway. But the setting up of the interviewers' tables. Each one had a table, and that's where the men appeared to them. That's where the interviews, and from there into the doctor's area where they were inspected for physical. They were given a physical. That was it every morning. I mean, it was just like
that.
They
came to you first.
Yeah, they came to us. They came to the interviewers first. And they were, we interviewed, I think I, somewhere along the line you have an idea of what it was to interview one of these people, or a group of people. And it was quite an experience, to say the least. Most of these people are very, very humble. They're respectful. They were easy. And they, of course, when they appeared before us, they were a little scared. I could tell, you know, they never probably ever talked to a U.S. inspector, or much less a U.S. citizen, probably. So they were, you could tell, they tipped their hat to you when they came to you, and they kind of bowed a little bit, and they were very, very humble. And that was always one of the tip-offs as to what type of person you had in front of you. And that went a long ways towards your inspection of this person. But it was going through the questioning, where they're from, what they did, and if you had any reason to believe they weren't a campesino or a field worker, you went into it a little more deeply. And it wasn't very long before you realized if you had a bona fide bracero, and you could pass him on to the medics. That was basically what we did every morning for time after time.
After the medical inspection, what would happen then?
Well, we sent him to an area. It was pretty confined inside. There wasn't very much room to have people standing around. So as quick as they were contracted, they had their little piece of paper, little contract with all their. That was what they showed later at the border when they were arrived up there. They were readily taken outside to another area where they were lined up for transportation. Now this transportation there was a lot to be done, especially by the managers, to get together with Gobernacion to find out exactly how many people are going to be, so we get the amount of transportation necessary to take these people to the border. They were going a long ways. They're going to El Centro, California, most of them at that time. And we had to have even the people making lunches and meals for them. There wasn't any hot meals given in Guadalajara. All of it was box lunches. So a box lunch was given for so many hours, and if they were going to be 10, 12, 15 hours on the road, sometimes all day long, they were given enough lunches, maybe two or three lunches, so that it would last them. And the water and all that was provided for them by the transporter, and along the ways where they had resting places. But mainly, it was quite a problem to get all this arranged, feeding and transportation for all these people. But all that necessarily had to be arranged. If we could find out how many we're going to need the next day, all that transportation was set up ahead of time so that the transportation would be there. You can imagine how many buses and trains. And one time we had airplanes take them.
Really?
Yeah. Joe Gonzalez can tell you more of that. I didn't get involved in that thing, but we had I think, if I'm not... They were converted. I don't know. I that's been a long time. I think they were converted military planes, but they carried. I don't know. And that's where Joe would probably have to tell you. I never wrote any checks for transportation because I wasn't head of transportation at that time. I was over in Monterey later on, which I was really knowledgeable of how the transportation feeding went because that was my baby. See. But in Guadalajara, once they got out that door, we interviewers knew a little about how that transporting was being done because that was all arranged by the Mexican government, as far as I remember.
Let's talk a little bit about Monterey. When you went to Monterey, you went in what year?
We went in 1954. That's the year it was closed there in in Guadalajara. I guess we're there maybe a couple of years there in Guadalajara. And, honey, ¿qué año fuimos a Monterrey de Guadalajara? ¿Te acuerdas? ¿Te acuerdas el 54? Ya había nacido Roberto, ¿no, Bobby?
Sí.
53.
Ajá, pero ¿sabes qué? Llegamos a Monterrey y nació Roxy.
Ah, nació en mayo de 54.
Tú fuiste tantito antes y luego yo fui y en una semana nació Roxy.
Ah, bueno, entonces llegamos ahí en mayo 54. Ajá. Más o menos en mayo 54. Mayo 54.
¿Tú llegaste como fines de febrero? No.
Fue en marzo.
De marzo o abril. Y al poquito, y después yo llegué. Tú estabas ahí antes con Joey, con Joe González.
Ah, oh, sí.
Fuiste cuando abrieron el centro en Monterrey.
Oye, ¿no te acuerdas de un trabajador ahí, güero, mexicano, que hacía mucho de los, como supervisión ahí en la oficina de Guadalajara? Uno güero, ojos azules. Era muy amable el muchacho. El señor era mayor que yo creo, en ese tiempo. Era de Nueva México. No me puedo acordar de su nombre, lo estoy viendo en la cara. Así.
Sí, estuvo poquito tiempo en Guadalajara.
Pues no fue, se regresó a Nueva México de ahí y nosotros nos fuimos de Guadalajara. Pero no me acuerdo cómo se llama. Joe González va a conocer bien porque pues todos son de esa área, ¿no? Así es que no me acuerdo. Bueno, no le hace. Yo llegué para ir allá, yo creo que en. Pues ¿sabes qué?
Abril.
¿Sabes qué? Me acuerdo que la señora González, Opo, ajá, la esposa de Joe,
sí,
fuimos en marzo y estaba haciendo 104 grados.
Por eso te digo,
en marzo,
antes que yo llegara.
En marzo, sí, me acuerdo.
Y ella no había vivido en un clima así.
No, venía de...
Estaba recién casada.
Sí.
Es más...
Estaba esperando.
Ella nació su baby el 3 de mayo.
Sí, sí, sí.
Y Roxy nació el 12 de mayo, pero ella estuvo ahí como dos semanas antes y se estaba muriendo de calor. Eso fue
bueno,
lo que tú llegaste.
Llegamos en marzo, para estar seguro, March of, because we're in March of 54. I'm sure of that now because I remember it was.
¿Marzo o abril?
No, era marzo. Marzo. Que sea seguro porque se me hizo muy raro.
Sí,
que
fue un poco tiempo.
Sí, bueno. Marzo 54, cuando se abrió el centro ahí en
Monterrey.
En Monterrey.
En Monterrey estuvimos 8 años.
Sí, nos fuimos. Nosotros nos fuimos en el 63. Llegamos en el 4, sí, eso. Más o menos 9 años.
8 o 9 años en Monterrey.
9 años en Monterrey.
Y en ese intermedio cerraron Irapuato.
No, Irapuato siguió trabajando.
Sí, pero en algún tiempo de esos cerraron Irapuato. Y tú fuiste a Irapuato a recoger todo. Y en ese tiempo, cuando te mandaron a ti, nació Rolly.
Eso fue en 57, cuando cerraron allá en Irapuato. Sí.
Ajá. Y tú fuiste a cerrar el campo.
¿Cuándo nació en...
Rolly.
Marzo.
Marzo 14.
All right. Del 57. Ok, ajá. Bueno. Qué bueno, porque así me da idea que... ¿Cuándo se cerró el centro allá en Irapuato? Sí. Abrieron al mismo tiempo. Abrieron ahí en julio del 50... July 51 de Open Irapuato.
El mismo tiempo que Guadalajara.
Sí, el mismo tiempo que Guadalajara.
Que te ofrecían Irapuato o Guadalajara.
Ah, sí.
Y fuimos a Guadalajara.
Bueno. All right. Eso todo se está poniendo aquí en el casero, lo que estamos diciendo, yo creo. Se van a divertir aquí viendo qué.
Lo que va a pasar es que vas a ver la historia de 9 hijos.
No, ya lo sabes.
Well, no, not everything. I don't know. By no means. I'm learning. Okay. Thank you. When you arrived in Monterrey, what was it like? What was the facilities like again? Did you start?
I think we had again? None of us. I don't think had ever been to Monterrey before. At least I hadn't. It's an industrial city of Mexico. Outside of Mexico City, Monterrey was considered probably the most industrial city of all northern Mexico. And so we got there, it was quite a thing to find housing for ourselves. That was one of the first problems. But we readily found there was a colonia in Nahuac, just north of the city, about 3 or 4 miles, I guess, and a brand new little suburb, and that's where most of us settled down to live, in a little community all together. We lived very much in one community there, and so it was again the same feeling of togetherness when all the new personnel start coming in.
Did you have additional personnel?
Yeah, we had different. There was a different group there. The group that was in Guadalajara apparently didn't care to go over to. I don't know what the circumstances, but you can ask Joe and Silas why all the personnel didn't transfer. There in Monterrey, we had when we got there. Of course, Joe came as the manager, and there was an assistant manager by the name of Lloyd Goodman. Lloyd Goodman was the assistant manager, and then I was selected as a supervisor. Another fellow by the name of Guy Mueller was a personnel supervisor, Guy Mueller. Another person by the name of Lee Burdick. Now, all these people had gone to school with me there in Mexico City College, and they're all graduates there about the same time I did. Lee Burdick graduated the same day I did. There is three people that were hired right out of Laredo, Texas. Manuel Prado, Humberto Treviño, and Ernie Guevara. There were three that worked. They worked all those 9 years there, and we were all together for all that time. And an older fellow at the Monday. Hey, sí. ¿Cómo se llamaba entonces? ¿Qué es? ¿Cómo se llama?
Lo que vive en el Laredo ahora.
Sí, sí.
No, no es Guevara.
¿No es Guevara?
No.
Es semejante.
No, es. Ahorita te digo.
Ernie. Bueno, okay.
Pero no es Guevara.
No es Guevara, all right. Well, it's something like it. Well, anyway.
Okay.
Later, an older person by the name of Henry Miller showed up. He was already something like 72, 73 years old, but spoke Spanish rather well. And he worked there off and on, 2 or 3 years. But that mainly was the personnel. And of course, they had so much Mexican typist. They must have had, must have been 10 or 15 Mexican typists, because we had days that we had 5,000 men to interview and to write up. It took a little bit over 8 hours. They worked sometimes early morning to the evening, sometimes worked 10 or 15 hours to get all those people out. We had a bunch of willing people to work under pretty trying circumstances. It wasn't the air conditioning in the building, it was wide open. It was a military camp where we opened up. One of the barracks. Actually, it was one of the barracks, and we set up the barracks with desks and typewriters and a little office for the manager. And then when we got there, of course, Joe and Silas was the manager. Later on, Joe left after about a year, year and a half. He was there. A fellow by the name of Auxilio Vasquez. Auxilio Vasquez was out of New Mexico. He was an older person, but he readily was there. I don't know how much, maybe a couple of years, 2 or 3 years. And then when Auxilio Vasquez went, we had a person by the name what was his name? ¿Cómo se llama el que tomó el lugar de Auxilio Vasquez? Vergara, uy, 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 ¿cómo? Bueno, fíjate, Guevara y Vergara, that's not too far off.
No, not too far
Guevara
off.
Guevara y Vergara.
I can't even remember names, so. Yeah.
¿Cómo se llamaba?
Que tomó el lugar de Ocelio Vázquez.
Sí, la esposa. Vienen de México. No tenían familia, ¿te acuerdas? Ritzman.
Marvin. Marvin y Chela Ritzman.
Yeah, Marvin Ritzman came in as a manager after Ocelio. And he was the one that stayed there until the center closed. Uh-huh. Yeah. So that was a sequence with Joey González.
Ese después siguió Marvin Ritzman.
Sí, Joey González, Ocelio Vázquez.
Y después Marvin Ritzman. Then Marvin hasta el final,
Ritzman,
¿no?
Hasta el final, sí. So that was a sequence.
Okay. Can you talk to me a little bit about, was it the same kind of routine as in Guadalajara?
Yes. It was just about 10 times as large. It was all, the military camp gave us a lot of liberty to hold a lot of people. And I remember having one terrific picture. In fact, there was a series of three photographs that I took from up on top of all the people that were waiting out there in the area to be contracted. There were thousands of them. People look at that, it looked like you know, just a massive amount of people waiting out there to be contracted. And they wouldn't leave anybody or let anybody on the base that really wasn't called to be contracted. We had a lot of military people kind of keeping order there. But you can imagine the a situation where you had a lot of barracks, quite wide. I mean, I think it was wide open. And Gobernación would have a special way of getting them in through quarters over to us to be interviewed. But that was amazing. And then, of course, I was a transportation and feeding supervisor, so I also had to keep going way ahead on this thing. You can imagine transportation daily for 2,000 or 3,000 people.
How did you do that?
It just had to be on the phone all the time. You just had to keep in contact with the liaison men for the bus companies and for the railroad. Mexican Railroad was anxious to get to work because a lot of money involved for transportation, and so we'd call up, and I remember 50 trains or 50. Now these were boxcars. They did have at times coaches, old beat up coaches. I don't know where they got them out of, but they had beat up coaches, and of course these men were very happy. No air conditioning, naturally everything was open, and people hanging out over everything, but the boxcars were kind of lamentable because, you know, the boxcars just have a door open on one side and door on the other side, and there's no way really of no steps or anything to really get the people up in the cars. Everybody jumped in, and I mean it was just things, and they were happy to get up in there. Amazing, you know. And we had these big water barrels inside with paper and a little kind of a spigot. The bad thing was that these barrels were large and well valued by everybody en route, so they had to be very careful, and many of them were stolen. Oh yeah, they ripped the seating out of there, because wood was brand new. You know, they built all these seats around there, and there's a lot of wood involved in making these seats, and if they weren't taken care of, they'd come back and I'd had to go in. We'd had to spend people in to look to see if all everything was in there first. Their water in there, their cups in there, and if the seats were in place. I mean, this is the way it was, and it was kind of archaic in the sense that, man, it brings back the memory of 8 or 48 in World War I. The U.S. soldiers were transported sometimes in these cattle cars, and they had a number like that, either 48 cows or 48 men, something this to this thing. And I remember, Chief, here are these men going in there, and they're stacked inside. They're stacked inside, 75, 100 people in a car. And sometimes we had to do that to get them out, because we just didn't have enough transportation. Sometimes it'd be short, 2, 3, 4 cars, and we'd have to do that. But later on, we got together with a bus company that had a fleet. They were able to get about 100 buses together, and we'd run them day and night over to Piedras Negras and we'd run them over to no, not Piedras Negras, not from there. We ran him over to Reynosa in Hidalgo, Texas. This was one of the routes. And the other route was, of course, to El Paso, from down to El Paso to, boy, my mind is fading. They were going over to Eagle Pass. That's right, that was Eagle Pass, where they were divided going into the United States. Those are two big centers at Hidalgo and at Eagle Pass, Texas was a big receiving center for all the Raceros. That's where we sent them. But it really was a challenge to have transportation and feeding all set up so that you could feed these people. And there they did get a hot meal. They did get a hot meal.
Why was it different in Monterey?
Yeah, it was meat, potatoes, and beans, and tortillas. It's a massive, you know, it was an army kitchen. It was all stone tables and a huge area for cooking. These huge army stoves, as you can imagine. And to make beans for 1,000, 2,000, 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 people took a lot of doing, a lot of time. You know, beans didn't cook over an hour or two. It took a long time to cook beans and cook the meat. We had to inspect this very closely. The lunches were made out of sausage, Mexican sausage. They call it mortadela, and bread, regular sandwich bread. And the weight had to be exact because we stipulated so many ounces per meat per sandwich. There wasn't anything else put in it because couldn't really put any mustard or all that stuff in there because the weather was most of the time would spoil. But we did love chilies. Yeah, chili. And the Mexicans, at least that group of campesinos, all of them, I don't think there was an exception, they all were chili eaters. So you put a chili or two inside the sandwiches, stuff like that, to make it more or less palatable. But we had very few problems with these people as far as feeding them is concerned. Long, long lines, and we went as fast as we could. We had these iron trays, steel trays with these little compartments on there, and give them a steel tray and their forks. We didn't give them no knives because everything was chopped up. The meat and all that was chopped up where it wasn't, didn't need any knives. We did have iron forks for all of them. And we seen them down, we'd eat them, and then run them out, and another group, and another group, and this was all day long. You know, I can't imagine what a big movement this was to feed these people. And they were all very satisfied with that type of food. Nobody ever got sick, as far as I knew.
You fed them, and and at the same time...
Immediately, almost immediately from the kitchen area, we'd line them up on the train. Train tracks ran right behind the kitchen, about 200 or 300 feet, the railroad line. We made it real nice. You line them up according to cars, maybe 50 or 60 or 70. I don't remember exactly but there was over 50 in each boxcar, and ready to get them in there. And I personally would see it. Everybody was on there, and everybody was ready to go. And I, together with the representative of the Mexican railroad company, we'd all count together to be sure that all our counts was the same, and then. We'd rarely miss people, and people were contracted, mainly were up aboard. We knew how many were contracted, and so we had counters. We'd count all these people, and I'd make them a check, a government check. I personally wrote out a Mexican check.
For every day? Every day?
Every day. After every movement, we went down I didn't give the check to the person, to the railroad representative. He helped me count and everything, and verified the count and everything. And then I would drive over to the train terminal, walk into the main office, and go into the finance department there. We sit down, wrote him out a check, sign it over to him. That was it for the day for that transportation.
All day.
Just actually one check for the whole.
Do you remember how much per person?
Don't remember. Don't remember.
That's
maybe Joe. Yeah, I don't remember how much there was. I really don't. But it was
Did you pay him in dollars or pesos?
These were dollars.
U.S. dollars.
U.S. dollars, see. And government check is just not like ordinary personal check. It's a kind of a... what do they call these checks? They had some name for them, I don't remember. But they were checks that had a lot of writing on there, government this and government that and everything. And everything had to be foolproof on that check, which they readily accepted. And we never had any problem with that.
Now, what about the food? How did you pay them for
food? We'd count that also. We'd count the people coming into the kitchen, and we wouldn't pay on a daily basis, but they readily were paid by the main office. I don't remember making any personal or having personally involved in making checks out for the food. I think it was done by Mr. Gonzalez, Joe Gonzalez, in the main office. I think so. You know, it's been a long time. They're very happy. These feeder contractors were bid on the food. Several people, you know, two or three or four groups would bid on this feeding. So you always had the lowest price with the same meal. Whoever got it cheapest win. That they get the contract. A lot of money involved, as you can imagine, per lunch. I don't remember how much at that time. Naturally, I knew, but I don't remember now how much was the cost of each sandwich was. But readily run into a lot of money.
I'm sure.
Readily run into a lot of money. So, and we'd work all during the summer, and then even during the winter, there was two or three months that wouldn't do a thing. So, in order to keep busy, we'd play badminton. We put up a badminton court inside the contracting center. Played poker. Don't tell anybody. But played poker. We really try to keep busy. 8 hours. We'd go in the morning, go back, you know. Even if we didn't have anything to do, we still were on a job. The whole bunch, all these women, all these people showed up.
They never
up.
Let anyone go during the slow season?
No. Everybody was hired. I mean, because things did come in. They trickled in. But you never know when they wanted 100 men or 2,000 men, especially during the winter, where it wasn't that much demand. But that was quite an operation for the Mexican government to go into these different municipalities all over Mexico and send people to these centers.
So the government, the Mexican government, obtained the people in the different provinces.
That's right.
You had nothing to do with that.
We had nothing to do with
that. They gathered the people, they recruited them, and they brought them to you.
They brought them to us, and we went through the interviewing procedure. But it was always up to Gobernación and for them to figure out how to do that. Of course, that took a lot of figuring because there's a lot of money involved. A lot of money involved in getting these people to the center from different places of in Mexico, and the government, as I remember, didn't pay their way up there. They got up there the best way they could from their different municipalities. And I think that if you go back and into the interviews with these people in Mexico, which I think you're doing, you'll really find out what these people had to go through to get to the border. You know, they would sell their own personal possessions, sell a cow or sell a horse or something enough to pay the transportation up to the border. But in Monterrey, we had a little more difficult time because we were in an industrial area, and it was easy for all types of people to infiltrate into those lists, into the Mexican lists. And we interviewed them anyway, but we had a lot of people there and really weren't bona fide. Our percentage of... And we had a chart of all the people that were presented, the people that were interviewed and accepted, the people who were not accepted. We knew exactly how many out of 1,000 people, what the percentage was that weren't bona fide, we felt weren't bona fide workers. And readily was a pretty good job of getting this type of worker that the United States was interested in having, especially the field worker. Yeah, because Many, you can imagine many of these people had relatives in the United States and wanted to get up there any way they could. Of course, the borders at that time was like a sieve anyway. They could go through much easier than they can nowadays, of course. But to get up there legally, all they had to do was have a contract and go to the United States. And many times they did work. There's no doubt about it. They worked there 2 or 3 months, maybe 4 months during the season. And many of them stayed. Many of them stayed. There wasn't any check. There wasn't any checking by us, I forgot to tell you, we had U.S. Immigration Service there also. So these people were pre-screened as far as immigration concerned.
What would they do?
Well, they'd go through, they'd ask them, you know, if they ever been in the United States, if they have, how they get there, where they were formed. They were interested to see if they were formally deported. You see, you can imagine out of so many thousands and consequently millions of men that were contracted, there'd be a percentage of them there. They weren't really good people. Probably had a lot of criminals in the group. A lot of people that wanted to get back to the United States that were deported. Many of these people might have been deported one time. And this is their job to find out if they were being in the United States. There wasn't any system that I remember by immigration to see their background. Like now, you know, they put the name in a computer and boy, it's amazing how much information they have now about everybody that's ever come to the United States. At that time, it was all a hit and miss. But the inspectors, with their expertise just talking to them to see how nervous they would get and not see what they're answering their questions and everything, they had never had any trouble with a campesino. That man was, he was bona fide. He was 24 karat gold, the people that were actually bona fide. But I said that was the majority of them, but not so in Monterey. Monterey, we were subjected to a lot of people who weren't campesinos, and some of them were sturdy, some of them were strong. Naturally, we accepted them. The Mexican government got a little upset with us when we would refuse a lot of their people. Now you have to realize that many of these people, many of these people had to make some kind of financial arrangements with the Mexican government to get on these lists, you see. And if they weren't contracted, you can imagine them going back and say, hey, I want my money back, or something to that effect. You know, there's a lot of them. Most of these bona fide workers would arrange with the municipalities, and they would do all the arranging of if they got any, if there's any money involved or not. And there was. There's no doubt about it. We knew it, and everybody else knew about it. But the local people would readily, that list would come in from the interior of Mexico, then people would present it to us. Weren't really all those interior, they had a lot of people who would infiltrate from the city itself and different people that weren't really bona fide, and that was up to us to try and cull those people out. And I think I told you at the beginning that the demeanor of these people, their physical appearance, like I say, mainly their hands. I think it went through this.
That's okay.
Their hands were so important to us. To see that working hands anywhere in the world are all the same. They're sturdy, sturdy, rough, strong hands. Especially people in the field. You can tell them, their hands shine with so much work they've done. I mean, the calluses on there, they're there. I mean, they've worked in that, and they carry those calluses day in and day out for all their lives, most of those people are in the fields. And it was very noticeable when one showed up with silky white hands or something like that. We'd readily, it might have been one of the main causes of refusing their entry, was to find out these people had never done any field labor in their lives. And but God, that really in itself didn't really disqualify them, because there was times that it was hard to get enough people to contract. I mean, not all
were
the time.
Sure?
At times, you know, we had to go along with Gobernación. You know, they wanted to see that these people come through for some reason or other, and maybe they were accepted in a sense, but it didn't mean that they couldn't work in the fields. Just like today, you have thousands of people coming to the United States. They're kids and young men, and people want to live in the United States. They'll work in the fields because that's the only work they have available once they get there. But once they know the ropes of the United States after having worked in the fields 2 or 3 years, then they go into different little restaurant jobs, landscaping jobs, field, not something not related to field. I mean, it's easy to do once they find their orientate themselves. Some of them marry young there so that they can be immigrated and marry U.S. citizens, so that their immigration is almost immediately. And the field worker, that was quite a challenge to us, all of us. I didn't do much interviewing once I got to Monterey because all my job was getting these people fed and transported. But I was in the office much of the time, and I could, and I was kind of say like a veteran. I kind of filled in these other people. I was an instructor to these new people coming in. You know, here's what we want. Here's what we're looking for, because we had all the experience from Guadalajara. We were the only ones. The only one that went over to Monterey, I was the only one. I was the only one that came over there except Joe Gonzalez. So the rest of them went to other centers, Irapuato. Some of them went to Irapuato and later on to Guaymas. But we had quite an operation there in Monterey.
How did you decide who went to California, who went to Texas, who went?
We didn't decide at all. That was all decided at the centers in the United States. El Centro would call Joe Gonzalez, for instance, in Monterey, say we want 500, and some of them were specified as to what type workers would, if they could, get people to pick cotton, people for, like I said before, one of the elite jobs was date picking. And you really had to know what you're doing in date picking, because you handled buckets and ropes, and you got up in these trees, and it readily paid well, and there was pretty good work, and they readily wanted to get there. So we sometimes were able to get people who were specializing in different type works. Not all the time, but we did. I remember having called different people out and segregated them as to where, and their contracts to specify that they were going to a certain area. I don't know. No, we never put any farmer's name in there. We just once they got to the borders, they knew, the farmers knew what, how many men of that particular work was available to them. But they generally it was all labor. They all were able to work in anything you gave them to, really. But it was all up to the farmers and the contracting centers there in the border to ask for the men.
Do you recall the contracting centers? Do you recall where they were in the United States? The different places?
Well, the main one was in El Centro, California. They readily were set up for this type of work, and they were coming through Eagle Pass, Texas. They were coming through El Paso. Coming through Hidalgo, Texas. Up there near Brownsville, down way down that area. Hidalgo, Texas took a lot of men. But El Centro, Eagle Pass, and Reynosa or Hidalgo were the main offices. You can rectify a lot of this stuff through Joe Gonzalez, because he was more he was directly in contact with the centers. We as supervisors and interviewers, no, we had little contact in that area. That was up to the managers and assistant managers to take the amount of people needed on a daily basis. So at night they would find out what they needed the next day, and sometimes we'd know several days ahead of time. So it was days that we just contracted as many as we could get out. And there was thousands and thousands and thousands. I mean, we run over 500,000 people a year. That's a lot of people.
It's a lot of people.
Well, I think over the period of all this time, I think there were some over 5 million contracts during that time. So you can imagine the amount of work and the transportation, the feeding, and all this operation to get these people. Many times it was the same person come in year after year, maybe twice a year they would come in, and go again. Oh, yeah.
You see this repetitive.
Oh, yeah. You get to know people and see people now and then that you've seen before. Some, but they readily were given little cards. I think in one of your brochures there or something, I saw a little card. I think it's the one, it was the 100 form, a little form, SW100 or something, a form that the immigration later gave the worker. When he went back into Mexico, they gave him, when they went in, immigration would give him a little card back. They'd pick it up once they come to the United States and then give it back to them when they came in. And that little card was a little gold mine for these people. Oh, they loved that little card. It had their picture on there and their name, date of birth, place of birth, and where they were contracted. So they readily carried that card. Of course, like everything else, a lot of them were lost and a lot of them were used by other people. But mainly they give them identification to go come back in. So it was easy. Over a period of time, you'd set up a line. You'd set up a line where you'd call all those who have this certain type, have been contracted and have identification, get them in one line. And that was so easy. Thank you, Mia. Thank you. All right. But that was nice after time when you had these people who were contracted before. Made it very easy for immigration. They gave that card, and so when they saw the card, there was very little interviewing after that. They'd send them real quickly into different areas to get them out, get them through. See, so that made it real nice, that little identification card they got when they arrived in Mexico, and when they returned, they got the card back, and they kept it until the next season or come in later on if they were called or if they were able to get another. It was all depends where they went back to, if they got on the list again. The municipalities, you know, they're the ones that readily have 100 people out of this little town, another 100 from the next town, another 100 from the next town, and this went all over Mexico. It went all over Oaxaca, Veracruz, Mexico. All the states, the powerful states were contracted were Michoacán, Guanajuato, Jalisco. You know, that was the really the heart of agriculture in Mexico. And most of all the cities at one time or other were sending people to the United States. And that's why it would probably be easy for whoever went into Mexico to interview these people. There's still, you find hundreds of them, all these little towns. People, you might find people that went to the United States and stayed 20 years. They made their little money and everything. They come back and they're retired in Mexico in their little house that they built with the monies they made in the United States. Like I said before, the Bracero income for the Republic of Mexico was right up there in the 1, 2, 3. Tourism, petroleum, and Braceros, the money comes from all these industries, so to speak, was important for the Mexican economy. And the Braceros brought in a lot of money. To this date, billions of dollars are being sent into Mexico by the people who are working in the United States, legally or illegally. A lot of that money gets back to their families in Mexico. So you can see that this was an operation that was very important to Mexico at that time, for at least all those 12 years that I was in it. All that money was coming back to Mexico. People would make good little change, and I saw it personally in a little town in Jalisco I used to visit every year. These people come in and have their nice little houses. They built their little houses. You know, it only cost $1,000 to make a little house, $1,000 at that time. But they built a little house, and that was the start. It was awfully nice to see money put to work in Mexico.
After Monterrey, where did you close the center there as well?
No, I didn't close the center there. I was given a promotion.
Okay.
I was given a promotion to assistant manager. I went over to the center at Chihuahua City, Mexico. Chihuahua City, Chihuahua. Chihuahua City is the capital of the state of Chihuahua. That's about 300 kilometers south of El Paso. I went there in, I don't remember what month it was. It was the year 63. I don't remember exactly what month that was. My wife would know, I think. But It was 63 that I went there as assistant manager. At that time, the manager was ready to leave. The manager who was there originally, a fellow by the name of Costello. I don't remember what his first name is. He was an elderly person, a one-armed person. I remember him having one arm, and his name was Costello. And all these older people that were in Mexico with a labor program come out of the labor department in the United States. Consequently, they went back to their labor departments in the United States. Not many of them, but some of them were. And the one that took over in Chihuahua, the station manager, a fellow by the name of Bonfilio, Gene Bonfilio, very nice fellow. He was also a graduate from Mexico City College. Gene Bonfilio was a manager, and I was assistant manager. And we together were able to set up the offices were already set up. They're always set up as the same on the same manner as the one in Guadalajara and Monterrey. They had their interviewers. At that time, we had there weren't too many interviewers, U.S. personnel. We had a fellow by Henry Miller, who was off and on working there in Monterrey. He was steady there at for at least a year or two there in Chihuahua, in our center in Chihuahua. The older person, his name, like I say, is Henry Miller. Myself, another person out of El Paso. But we didn't have too many interviewers there. It was a smaller operation. I don't think we ever got over maybe 500 people at a time. But we did have the same setup of buses and trains to leave the center. It was run also on a railroad spur, and it came right by the office there in Chihuahua. And so we had mainly the same situation. The people were given to us to interview by the Mexican government. They selected the people to come in. We'd interview them, pass them on to public health. Actually, there wasn't any public health U.S. personnel there, but the doctors were working for, you might say, for public health. They did the work, all the physical examination to see if the people were physically able to do their job once they got to the United States. And that was quite a procedure for those people, the doctors especially. It was quite a situation. Imagine all these people, none of them had bathed for days and days and days. And I don't know, they had to wear masks. And they did, they had to work, and they were really working under a real difficult situation, the doctors. They're all medical doctors, every one of them. We got to know most of them. All of them had their own little professions and their offices and everything, but they were able to work down there at least 8 hours a day. But it was the same procedure. They got their contracts. We fed them. We didn't have hot meal for them there in Chihuahua. They were only giving them box lunches. And again, according to the time on the road, we gave them 1, 2, 3 lunches there in Chihuahua. It changed just a little bit. Instead of the bread, sandwich bread, it was given Mexican loaf, a little loaf they call bolillo, and it was readily accepted a lot better than bread, because that was kind of bread that these people were used to eating. But they'd give the minced ham, you might say, or the meat, the special specifications, and it was a pretty good little sandwich. It was a lot better than other places. This Frenchman who had the contract was readily diligent. He made the bread. Right there, he had his own bakery, so the bread was produced by him, and it was quite good. That was a very good lunch given to them to go wherever they were going, mainly to Eagle Pass and to Chihuahua. Went to El Paso and to Eagle Pass, yeah. So the operation was quite big there also, but it didn't last that long. It readily closed down. When he closed that, from there, from Chihuahua, I was sent personally to a center in they call it Guaymas. It was on the Pacific coast.
Do you remember what year that was?
Yeah, that was, let's see, 64. I was there in Chihuahua 2 years. Let's see, all 63, 64. It might have been latter 64. I was there for about 8 or 10 months. And then, yeah, that center there in Guaymas, we lived actually in the city, on the port city of Guaymas, but we rode over to the, I think it was also a military camp there in Guaymas, where we contracted people. And there was a fellow, the manager there was a fellow by the name of Omero Toralba, B-A on the end, Toralba. He was also from New Mexico, but he was also a labor personnel. He came out of the United States from labor, and went back. I was assistant manager, and we had an old fellow there, an old timer really, by the name of Leo Eistetter. Leo Eistetter. Leo Eistetter was a supervisor there, and he readily got the people on and off the trains and all. We didn't have too many personnel, U.S. personnel there. Just three of us. And the same situation again, where they had the secretaries and men to put the people aboard the trains. But that was a smaller operation.
Could you tell that the program was getting smaller each year and
yes.
diminishing?
Yeah, I readily was sent to these places because the centers were closing down. See. I left Chihuahua because the center was to be closed down a certain amount of time, so I went over to Guaymas to finish it up there. And I was the last man. When we closed the center there in Guaymas, all the personnel left, and I was there to again hand in all the equipment and typewriters and anything that was assigned to the labor department was given over to the city or to the consulate in the area, see. So then I went back to Chihuahua. We closed up Chihuahua also.
Was Chihuahua in a military base as well?
Chihuahua, no. No, it was outside of the city there. Not too far. No, it wasn't a military base at all. The other military base was in Irapuato. I can't tell you too much about Irapuato because I worked there off and on when we had a low season in any of the other centers. We'd send our personnel to Irapuato because then we'd go over there, interview and help transport those people. On one occasion, we had an office in Hermosillo, Sonora, the U.S. government, where we contracted people in Hermosillo. Hermosillo, I mean, that's not for a long time, but Hermosillo, we sent people to the border. I was there on off and on for a while. Jack O'Grady was there, working a short time, and Lee Burdick was there in a little short time there in Hermosillo. It was hot. Hermosillo is the hottest place in the world. Wow! But we readily made lunches and sent the people on the different ports of entry through from Hermosillo. But all those were closing up. I was sent from Chihuahua to we closed there in Chihuahua, and I was sent from Chihuahua to Monterrey. In Monterrey, later on in the season, I don't know what year it was. Probably 62 or 63. They went to a little town outside of Monterrey called Apodaca. It was a small town. So when they closed the center up in at the military camp there in In Monterey, they opened up this little center out there outside of Monterey called Apodaca. And all the operation went out there. It was there, I don't know how many months, but they did work out there at Apodaca. And I remember having gone there to close that center also. I wasn't there when they made the transfer from the military camp there in Monterey. I was there when everything was over in Apodaca, and I closed up and gave the keys and cars and everything again to the American Embassy there in Monterey, Mexico. Then I went back to Chihuahua, and I was separated there in Chihuahua. I got my orders, and I was last, like I said, I was the first one in, the last one out.
Tell me what it was like closing up this.
Well,
everything. What was it like for you, now that you reflect back?
Well, you know, it's like going back to a little ghost town, ghost city. So much activity, so many people, so many personnel, and a movement of people and trains and buses and everything. All of a sudden, you go back and it's just you go into a building and everything's quiet. All the typewriters and the government desks and all that, they're there. You take inventory. All the equipment has numbers on there. They all have serial numbers. So you get your list and all the serial numbers, check them off, put them in a transportation or a truck. We give them to the different places. I was assigned a little pickup all the time I was there in Monterey, and that little pickup stayed until the end. Wish I could have kept it. U.S. Department of Labor on to one side, and I use it all the time. But that little truck was also was handed over to the U.S. State Department or to the American Consulate there in Monterey. So everything was put away. You got signed signatures, and you send everything to the main office that you complied with what they wanted. And that's all, just the memories.
What's your personal opinion of the Bracero program?
Well, I think that's the greatest thing that ever happened to both countries at that time. And it could have worked so well for so many years. In fact, you hear so many comments of different people who not only were in the program like I was, but other people know that if they had kept this up, they wouldn't have all this problem they had today, see, about all these all this labor that's wanted by the United States. Now, these people, we knew that a lot of these people didn't want to come to live in the United States. Most of them didn't. They had their families and their children. They were all in Mexico, well set. All they wanted to do was have something to do, have enough money to build things they wanted to. And this is what they did. They worked 3-4 months. Contracts, some of them were very close. Some of them were 2 months, a month, 2 or 3 months. Some were recontracted there in the United States. They didn't all come back at the same time. If they needed different places, they were sent to different places. They were kept tracked of. Then they come back. They'd have their money with them, and they come back to Mexico, and here they were. They wanted to come back. And this is what actually the people in the United States wanted. They wanted to get their crops picked at the time they needed them, because sometimes those crops won't last over a few weeks. You got to pick them or they'll lose them. So that's what they want to do, is get those people in there and work, then come back. And we knew this. We knew this. To this date, this is all they want to do. They don't want to stay in the United States. They had no reason to stay in the United States. They want to come back home. But what forced them to stay was that they needed to work. And they had no contract, so they go illegally to the United States and consequently stay longer than they should. And then afterwards, they'd stay, and they'd separate themselves from the families. There'd be family problems. They'd probably take off with someone else. And all this social problem started between families in Mexico and the United States. And it readily would have been beautiful that they just stayed on some way. Later on, I was with immigration. They had the guest labor program where they come with under the H program, they'd H2, H3 or something, they'd come in and be given non-immigrant visas for temporary stays of 3 to 6 months, whatever they had to do. They'd work. They'd work in the fields, then come back with passports, just a regular worker visa. This is working very good, but they didn't carry that on too much. They'd do it off and on all the time, but that's the same as the Bracero program. Only it went through the State Department. They gave them a passport and a visa at the U.S. consulate or embassy, stamped in, they went to the border, give them permit, and they go to work in the United States. They probably, I don't know how that worked, but they probably had set up where they'd have a place to go immediately. They didn't wander around the United States to see if they could find a job. These people were always, I remember now, we even had orders for sheep herders. Sheep herders. Montana, you know, was sheep country. And we had a lot of these people at Roseros. They went up there and worked in the sheep. They loved that, you know, working up there in the mountains, good pay, and out in the open. They were used to that anyway. A lot of these campesinos were animal people, you know, handled cattle and sheep and goats and everything. They really got to work out real fine. They took over the vast job of sheep herding. Many of them liked, and probably after a while, they stayed on. You know, they got an immigrant visa because they were specialists. They knew how to handle sheep. It was a special industry in the United States, especially up in Montana. We did have requests for sheep herders. Not too many, but I remember we did have. That was quite a...
Is there any particular incident or person that you remember that stands out to you during this whole... while you were employed down there?
In what sense? As far as the job was concerned? Or
the job or... Is, that was good, you know. What was it like living down there for your family and everything?
Well, it was very good. And we were, as U.S. personnel, we had special privileges, you might say. We could go to the American Embassy's PX. They bought things by the truckloads. You know, American Embassy's, you can buy canned foods. Oh, even as when we worked there, we'd all get together and we'd send into the United States and bought, say, 10 cases of peas, 10 cases of this, 10 cases of this, and then when they got to the place we were, we'd separate it, you know. Everything was bought quite cheaply that way. Well, we could do it under the franchise of the American consulate. You know, we actually were attached to the American consulate, U.S. personnel working in Mexico. We were not consulate personnel, but we were, in a sense, U.S. government under the U.S. consulate of all the cities that you lived in. So we readily got that privilege of ordering things through the consulate. We had free housing. We had free schooling for the children. And I personally was able to buy a house with the money I was getting for my rent, something around $700-$800 a month. I had a little loan and I built a house in Monterey.
Really?
I was the only one out of the whole group that was able to do that. Found someone who said, yeah, the lot was cheap, put a house on it. We had a nice little home there. We lived in it from 57 to 63, 5 years in that little house. So instead of giving the rent out to all these, because we rented the best houses and we, you know, the money we were getting for rent, all of us had real nice homes. We all had maids. We had two maids all the time we were there. And that's what made it nice, having a big family and maids. It was, you know, that was one of the fridge benefits, and it was really nice to live in that area. To have your housing, children's schooling. And besides, your dollars went a long ways in Mexico, you know, because they could buy a little bit more than you would in the United States. Well, that was a real fringe benefit at that time. So that was nice. That was nice. And I got to know one person real well, a fellow by the name of Jack O'Grady, John O'Grady, but he was already a university graduate, very smart. In fact, he was a seminarian one time. But he went to Mexico, he spoke Spanish beautifully. Man, this güero, nice guy. We got along so well. I was later the best man at his wedding there in Guadalajara. But he's a personnel. He stayed in and became the representative for the United States Labor Department in Mexico City. He was really educated, a real good writer. And we got to know him. So he died of a heart attack here a while back. And it was quite sad, but that was very close friendship, a very close friendship. Of course, Joe and Silas, up to this date, were very close, as you'll find out when you if you get to see him personally. We have nothing but good things to say about each other. I think that's what it amounts to. But after all these years, after 40 or 50 years, we've never lost contact. And I see him at least once or twice a year. I talk to him more than that during the year. He had one child, and we're just part of the family.
What do you think attributes your closeness even to this day?
Well, being U.S. citizens in a foreign country, I think that's probably the same with a lot of people who go into any other foreign country. You have something in common. We were all veterans. Every one of us were war veterans. World War II veterans. No, the younger people that came, those two of the younger persons that came over from Laredo, Texas to us, they were born in the late 20s, so they missed the war, really. But they did go into service. But they didn't see any action, as far as I remember. Most of us saw action. Most of us, the older ones, were veterans who got schooling under the GI Bill, and many of us went to the same school together. But that was Lee Burdick, who is still, he lives in Chihuahua right now. We've kept up our friendship. All our group, in fact, anybody that's alive now that worked with us there, we're still in contact with them, sure, after all these years. But we went out together. We did a lot of partying together. We did a lot we just formed our own little community for all those years. And to this day, it's very steadfast, the friendship anyway.
Thank you, sir, for your time.
All right.